This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Deanna Fei, who explores the complexities of being a Chinese American.
I found that my identity was actually questioned much more often in China as a Chinese American than it ever was as an Asian American in America.
Motoko Rich has notes from the field. Jeremy McCarter leads us through the labyrinth of the contested identity of William Shakespeare.
The trouble is we read into the plays some autobiographical meanings that aren't there, thinking that when we're reading a Shakespeare play or even a Shakespeare sonnet, what we're hearing is Shakespeare's voice.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. The relationship between China and the United States grows ever more complicated, and most complicated of all, perhaps, for Chinese Americans. There's a new novel. It's called The Thread of Sky. It's by Deanna Fei. It's her first novel. It's reviewed for us this week by Amy Finnerty, who says Fei is a fluent storyteller who deals squarely and honestly with some complicated problems. Deanna, this novel involves a family, particularly daughters, and they make an important trip together.
Yes, it's the story of a family of Chinese Americans who have been estranged for the last year. And so the mother of this family has the idea of gathering her daughters, her sister, and her mother for an ancestral tour of mainland China. The novel traces their search not only for what it means to be from China, but also for a sense of family and for a new understanding of themselves and of one another.
And the daughters are kind of Americanized, right?
Exactly.
In fact, they're like super achieving American.
Exactly. They're super achieving to the point where she feels like it's only increased the distance between her and them, because she's a woman who also started out with really high expectations for her career and then sacrificed a lot for the sake of her daughters and being home with them.
And what's become of them?
They are the center of her universe, but they are going on to live their own lives, of course. The eldest daughter is a Wall Street trader, sort of a real hotshot who feels the need to prove herself among, you know, the big boys. And she is in this troubled relationship where she's just struggling to trust and to commit herself to marriage.
And who are the and what about the other daughters?
They've got
glittering resumes too, right?
Right, exactly. So the middle daughter is Kay. She's actually been an Asian American activist focused on the issues of Asians being portrayed as sexual objects or as helpless victims, just as something less than human in American media. And what she's been doing for the last year is living in Beijing and studying Chinese and also trying to get an outreach campaign off the ground in terms of reaching out to local prostitutes in Beijing. So she's somebody who can't stop searching for meaning in China and searching for a piece of herself. She's actually the only person in the family who's been focused on this search for her roots and this idea of trying to reclaim her heritage.
And the third daughter?
The third daughter is still in high school and is just feeling trapped at home with her mother until she can leave for college ever since the death of her father. And she's also struggling with an eating disorder at the time that this tour begins to take shape.
So they all go to China, and what do they find?
What this family finds is that they have a lot of barriers to overcome in understanding themselves, in understanding one another, and in understanding the land of their ancestors. China is a place that, for example, to the grandmother is an extremely loaded, extremely weighty place in her own history. She was actually a revolutionary and a leader of the Chinese feminist movement before the Civil War broke out, which is when she had to flee. And so China's a place that she never, ever thought that she would return to, and she's actually the one who's most reluctant to return when her daughter calls to announce this family reunion. For the Americanized daughters, each of them has a different sense of what China means to them, if it means anything at all. Kay, the middle daughter, as I said, you know, she has this very strong sense of wanting to discover her Chineseness. Whereas the other two daughters, you know, at one point, Nora, the eldest, says, well, we might as well do an ancestral tour of Queens. I mean, that's where we're from, as much as from China. But what they all find is that they do discover a sense of what this place means to them in an individual way, not in terms of what other people define as, well, what does it mean to be Chinese? What does it mean to return to their roots? But through through touring the must-sees, and not only the must-sees, but also, you know, the back alleys and the shopping malls, that they do arrive at some sense of family and connection and a sense of what from China has filtered down through the generations to their present lives now.
Now, this is obviously a work of fiction. These are invented characters, but our listeners, I think, will sense that this is also rooted in the actual issues and quandaries and complexities of being a Chinese American. Are these the issues that, say, your generation is working through now? What's your own history?
I studied Chinese in Beijing for a year after I graduated college. I did have a sense of wanting to go back and, you know, sort of master my mother tongue.
So you were born here?
Heritage. I was born here. I was born in New York. So were my sisters. My parents emigrated first from China, then to Taiwan, and then to America in the early 70s. My first experience with Chinese was, it was actually my native language. I started speaking Chinese, you know, from the time I could speak.
And so it was spoken at home?
It was spoken at home. But then what happened was, as soon as I started preschool, my teachers actually told my parents, you can't speak Chinese to her anymore because she'll never learn English properly, which today seems sort of an absurd concept. Right. But back then, I mean, my parents took that very seriously. They did have a sense of, well, we're immigrants. We can't handicap our children in any way. And so they did that. They stopped speaking Chinese. And so I lost it all. And so it wasn't until I got to college that I started studying and then felt a sense of really wanting to reclaim that for myself. So I went to China for a year, and I didn't exactly go expecting to feel at home, but I don't think I expected to feel quite so alien as I did. I found that my identity was actually questioned much more often in China as a Chinese American than it ever was as an Asian American in America.
Question in what sense?
Well, where are you from? That's a question that a lot of Asian Americans learn to kind of recoil at, just because what it usually means is, we want to know where you're really from, you know, your ancestral home, not where you grew up in the States. And they find it bizarre if you don't really know.
Did you know?
I knew some of it. But what I found was that no matter what you can answer, the answer doesn't satisfy them. Because then it turns into, well, you know, you look Chinese, but you don't sound Chinese. You know, you say you're from America, but you don't look American. And it's just this constant negotiation that you find yourself doing where nothing ends up really defining you. You sort of feel like you're always in between the categories that people are laying out. At the end of that year, my own mother actually planned a tour of China for me, my sisters, my aunt, and my grandmother. And like any family vacation, it was full of frustration and tension and conflict, but also some moments of just being transported by the sights around us and sudden connection between us. And at the end of that tour, I came back to America just feeling like that trip was the perfect window into my own China experience. Just the huge complexity of the country, that sense of, you know, wanting to get a piece of it and finding it ever elusive. And also just the different points of view that is possible to have even just within one family on what it all means.
Thanks a lot, Deanna.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Deanna Fei, whose novel A Thread of Sky is reviewed in this week's book review. Motoko Rich is here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Motoko.
Hey, Sam.
William Styron, back in the news. He's being retooled for a new generation of readers.
He is indeed. He was one of a very popular writer in the 20th century. He wrote a lot of books that people will recognize titles of, either because they've heard of them or seen the movie, in the case of Sophie's Choice. But he also wrote Darkness Visible, which was a very critically acclaimed memoir about his depression. All of these books are still in print, but they don't actually sell that well. And by the time he died in 2006, his reputation, though stellar,
Had slipped a little bit.
And just, he wasn't someone that was read by the current up-and-coming generation of English majors, which his family totally acknowledges. And so along comes the digital world. And Jane Friedman, who's this sort of exuberant, longtime publishing person who was most recently the chief executive of HarperCollins, has founded this new company with Jeff Sharp, who's a film producer of movies like You Can Count on Me and Boys Don't Cry. And they're an ebook publisher. And the kind of their premise is that they're taking books just in this category, so-called backlist books that may have slightly fallen out of favor, and they're going to reinvigorate them through these sort of massive marketing campaigns online and sell the ebooks. So the promise to the Styron family is we're going to just blow it out here. We're going to film clips of Rose Styron, his widow, his daughters Alexander and Susanna, talking about his legacy. They put together a timeline. They went down to Duke, where all his letters and archives are. They're scanning in letters from Hunter S. Thompson to William Styron, filming movie clips about him, putting together all this material to put online, which they're going to push out in the social networking way on Twitter and Facebook and what have you. And so the family's very excited about this, but there was one hitch.
Well, he's got a longtime publisher.
He certainly does. Random House has been publishing him for virtually all of his career. And his college roommate and good friend was his editor, Bob Loomis. And so they had the rights to publish all the books in print. Most of the books that we're talking about, the famous ones, were published more than 15 years ago when contracts between authors and publishers didn't specifically stipulate ebooks because they just basically didn't exist and people didn't contemplate them. But the contracts had language like in book form. So Random House, back in December, Marcus Dola, the chief executive, had sent out this fairly strongly worded letter to literary agents saying these books are ours in any form. In book form will include electronic publishing rights, and specifically stipulated you cannot sell the ebook rights to these books to third parties.
So even though ebooks did not exist when these contracts were drawn up, mainstream or trade publishers are saying they still control the rights.
Absolutely.
To them.
I mean, they want to be able to preserve their right to publish these big name authors. I mean, in the Styron case, it might not have been true in recent years, but there are some older books that generate lucrative revenues for these publishing houses year after year after year. They appear every year on college and high school syllabuses all across the country, and people rediscover these writers. And they can easily sell thousands and thousands of copies of these books. And as this transition to ebooks occurs, and we don't know how fast it will be and how much more people will be buying ebooks instead of print books, they want to control those rights. They don't want to see them go away.
So how were these two new publishers, Jeff Sharp and Jane Friedman, able to do it?
It's a little bit of a mystery why Random House appears, for all intents and purposes, have just stood down in this particular case. The statement that they gave me was that this is a unique situation. The family was very committed to this idea because of the marketing plan. And they said they were torn because of their relationship with Random House and Bob Loomis, and there was nothing that they were unhappy about. But when I talked to Rose and to Susanna and to Alexandra, they said it's not as if Random House had a compelling alternative plan. It didn't feel as if they were offering to publish these books in digital form, and that's about it. Whereas Jane and Jeff were offering to do all this wonderful marketing stuff. I mean, nobody knows whether it's going to work. Hopefully it will draw new readers. I think Susanna said to me something like, at least one generation and perhaps two have not really read my father. So they really want to get his name out there and his work out there. And she made a really good point, which is that even people may discover him through these online marketing programs, through Twitter or Facebook or seeing a clip of her or her mother talking about him, and they may end up going and buying the print book. And that is Jane Friedman's argument, too. This is not necessarily damaging to Random House, that if someone discovers William Styron's work through this marketing initiative but decides, hey, I'd rather read in print, I don't own a Kindle yet, that will benefit Random House, which still continues to print the paper versions.
Thanks a lot, Motoko.
Thanks, Sam.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks. Audible is offering a free audiobook to listeners of this podcast. One book to consider is Solar by Ian McEwan. Solar is about a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, past his prime, who pushes through the messes in his personal and professional lives and tries to save the world from environmental disaster. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
It is now the very witching time of night when churchyards yawn and hell itself breathes out contagion to this world. Now can I drink hot blood and do such bitter business as the day would quake to look on.
Shakespeare can't get enough of him. There are three new books. One is Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare by James Shapiro. The second is Shakespeare's Lost Kingdom, The True History of Shakespeare and Elizabeth by Charles Beauclerk And the third is prefaces to Shakespeare by the great British critic Tony Tanner. They're reviewed for us by a younger great critic, Jeremy McCarter of Newsweek, who's here to talk about them. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Sam.
All right, so let's start with this whole thing about Shakespeare's identity. So there really are those who think he was another guy or somebody else was him.
Yeah, there are hundreds, thousands of people right now walking around making the case that Shakespeare wasn't really Shakespeare. In fact, James Shapiro, who wrote a history, his book is a history of the controversy, says that several new candidates came up even as he was working on the book over the last couple of years. This is a subject that will just never, ever go away.
Does that mean there's something to it?
There's something to it in the sense that the 16th century was a long time ago. The records aren't so great. Shakespeare was, he didn't leave a lot of paper behind. He left the plays, but outside of that, Stephen Greenblatt says the evidence is abundant but thin. And there are some people who say, well, this means the Glover's son from Stratford couldn't possibly have written these plays. But I think, and I think a lot of people think, that what's so great about Shakespeare's plays ultimately is that this Glover's son from Stratford had the massive imaginative faculty that he really did write Henry V and Merchant of Venice and all the other great plays in the canon.
We can't really know who Shakespeare is, and we know so little factually about him, he must have been somebody else. Right. Are there any really good candidates? Because there's some perennials, right?
I mean, Shapiro's book concentrates on the two that he considers the best documented, Francis Bacon and Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford. Shapiro is a judicious guy. In the course of his book, he explains why people came to think that Francis Bacon had the mental wherewithal and the skill to work with a bunch of other writers to write these plays. And de Vere, how his court connections would have given him the ability to write all of these court dramas and court comedies that Shakespeare wrote. I don't find those theories particularly convincing.
And does Shapiro? No.
No, he doesn't. He comes around in the end. The last part of his book makes the case for Shakespeare.
You mean for Shakespeare being Shakespeare?
That's right. Yeah, right. Sure. Shakespeare being Shakespeare is the last part. But Shapiro makes a more interesting claim at the end. He puts forward the argument that the trouble is we read into the plays some autobiographical meanings that aren't there, thinking that when we're reading a Shakespeare play or even a Shakespeare sonnet, what we're hearing is Shakespeare's voice. Shapiro wants to essentially step back from this idea that we can learn much about the author from what the author has created, which is, you know, something that a lot of people today would have trouble with.
Some of Shakespeare's contemporaries wrote about him, Ben Jonson for one. Did he think Shakespeare wasn't Shakespeare? Is there any record among his contemporaries or Christopher Marlowe or anyone else who might have moved in that world that there was somebody out there who wasn't Shakespeare? Because they acknowledge his genius. His genius wasn't a secret when he was working, right?
Right.
And did this question arise even then?
Well, no one – this is one of the things that Shapiro writes about, is that no one questioned Shakespeare's authorship for 150 years after he died. But once you go back and if you have doubts to begin with and you start looking at the evidence, you say, well, it's true that Ben Jonson wrote lots of stuff about Shakespeare and praised him and said that he was not for an age but for all time. But was he talking about the man from Stratford or was he talking about someone else? Because he certainly knew Shakespeare personally. Whoever wrote the plays was a friend and a colleague of Ben Jonson's and Marlowe's and lots of other people's. So either you need to believe that they are all working together to keep his real identity a secret, or you apply Occam's razor and say that they were, you know, being genuine when he talked about the, you know, Swan of Avon.
Okay, the next book, Shakespeare's Lost Kingdom. What's that about?
This is a book-length argument put forward by a descendant of Edward de Vere's, arguing that Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, wrote Shakespeare's plays. And the reason why we don't know that it was him is because his identity was a total secret. He was actually the illegitimate son of Queen Elizabeth. The Earl of Southampton, who was the may have been the fair youth of the sonnets, was there, and by there I mean the queen and the queen's son, Edward de Vere, their son. So it was the product of incest twice over. The Elizabethan court was a funny place. So
stranger things happen, perhaps.
Perhaps. I mean, this is getting up there in terms of the strangeness that's conceivable. But according to Beauclerk, if you read the plays with this history in mind, they come to life in a way that they don't now. So, for instance, Hamlet is a very complicated allegory about court life, where Hamlet is standing in for De Vere, and his thwarted ambitions are, you know, the source of Hamlet's gloom, and the scene with Gertrude in her closet is a sort of complicated attempt to win back the affections of Elizabeth.
So this is exactly what Shapiro is telling us not to do, right?
Right.
To read the plays in that
way. Right. This is, I don't think you could find a better embodiment of the thing that Shapiro is saying is leading Shakespeare scholarship astray.
Okay, now we come to an eminent critic, Tony Tanner. These are collected essays he's written over many years.
That's right. Tanner, before he passed away in 1998, had written introductions to, I believe it's the 7 volumes of the Everyman's Library edition of the plays. So he takes the comedies all together, he takes the Greek and Roman plays all together, the major tragedies, and they're just really wonderful. They don't try too hard to apply a theory. They're written from a state of pure love. Even when he's critical about them, you can tell he's engaged with this writing, with Shakespeare's work, as someone who has a great deal of affection for it that comes from enjoyment and from intellectual respect.
And are there illuminations along the way, jewels of insight?
There are. It's one of those books that once you get the hang of Tanner's point of view, part of the enjoyment is just watching a really smart person react to this stuff. So you're sort of enjoying it with him. I found the comedies, his essay on the comedies, the best. Mm-hmm. I thought that his treatment of the way that the themes of regeneration recur throughout the plays to be particularly sharp. He's not combative. He's willing to be very generous to the people who may not agree with him. He doesn't try too hard to do what Shapiro says we shouldn't do, which is to make wild leaps to try to understand the author behind the works. They're just a really delightful set of insights into the plays.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
Thank you.
It's Jeremy McCarter, who this week reviews 3 books on William Shakespeare. Jennifer Schussler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new in the list this week?
We've got new books on top of both the fiction and the nonfiction lists. Mary Higgins Clark is back on top of the fiction list with her latest, The Shadow of Your Smile. Interestingly, her daughter, Carol Higgins Clark, also enters the list this week. She's at number 8 with her latest mystery, Wrecked.
What else have we got?
Kitty Kelly on top of the nonfiction list with her tell-all biography, Oprah. It's been getting pretty mixed reviews. A lot of people say that there isn't that much fresh dirt in here. She's sort of digging up the clips and running with them. Being a follower of the bestseller list, I looked in the index in vain for some clues to some fresh gossip about Tolstoy, Faulkner, some of the classic authors she put on the list with her classics book club. Didn't find anything, but there is some kind of juicy stuff about the book club. You know, not every book that Oprah features on her show has made the bestseller list. And one publicist liked to say that you could kind of tell what was going to happen by reading Oprah's body language. The rule was, if she holds your book on her lap, maybe you'll make the list in 2 weeks. If she holds it at her waist, you'll be on the list within a week. If she clutches it to her bosom, you're headed straight for number 1.
Fascinating. Any other new titles?
Speaking of Oprah, the nonfiction this week kind of looks like Oprah's couch, Celebrity Books-A-Rama. Carol Burnett is at number 5 with her memoir, This Time Together. Jerry Weintraub, the Hollywood producer, is at number 9 with his book, When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. And Kate Gosselin, your favorite, enters at number 11 with I Just Want You to Know.
And what about the conspiracy man, Jesse Ventura, whom I wrote about in the pages of the New York Times?
Another celebrity politician. He's still at number 12 with his book, American Conspiracies. And he's joined this week by another political celebrity, Dick Morris. He enters at number 4 with his book, awkwardly titled 2010 Take Back America. It's sort of a hit list for vulnerable incumbent Democrats with some thoughts on how Republicans can take them down.
And this guy used to work for the Clintons.
Yeah, imagine. The perfidy.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Join us again next week on Inside the New York Times Book Review. Remember, there's more at our website, nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, this is Sam Tannenhaus.